Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I am Brian Ward. I'm joined tonight by Angela Weisang and Sydney Engel. Say hi, both of you.
We're here.
We are here, and we're back for another Fables from the Cribside, our show where we review and recap top insights from previous episodes of the show.
But before we get started, we'll remind you what we're all about. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. Usually in the show, we interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about the core topics in pediatric medicine.
Today, as with all of our Fables from the Cribsiders episode, instead of a conversation with one expert guest, we're taking a look back at three of our prior episodes with a focus on some common pediatric neuromuscular conditions. We're doing a spaced repetition recap of top pearls about muscular dystrophy, cerebral palsy, and trisomy 21. Before we get started, maybe we can do a couple quick picks of the week. Brian, you got anything?
Sure, I've got nothing, but I'll try. Before having a kid, I consumed very minimal pop culture, and now I think I consume no pop culture. And so my pick of the week is going to be like a throwback to, I'll say I've been listening to Lord of the Rings on audiobook, and it's, I'm in a huge nerd phase right now. It's fantastic. I won't give any spoilers for this book that's like 50 odd years old. But I'm right at the end and something big is about to happen and I know it's about to happen, but I'm still so hooked.
How long is each audiobook? Those are some pretty hefty volumes.
I don't know. I decided to listen to it at only 1.2x, and I don't know if anybody here is listening to our voice at 2x, but that's my default. It's taken a while. It's taken since the summer.
Oh my God. Are you listening to it with your son? Is he getting exposed to Lord of the Rings right now?
No. But that's my ultimate plan, is to get like nice leather bound The Hobbit through The Return of the King and go through all of them with him. I think that would be a really fun shared father-son activity. Right now, our favorite books are Pout Pout Fish and Chick Chicka Boom Boom, which is a great transition to Sydney. What are your picks?
I mean, don't get me started on children's book picks because I have many of them. But I'm gonna pick an adult book because I've actually read a couple of those. I'm in a book club, and that's kind of forcing me to get back into reading, which I love. But one of the books I read recently that I really loved is called "I'm Glad My Mom Died" by Jeanette McCurdy. It's pretty out there. I'm not like picking some obscure book. I think it's gotten a lot of press around it. Exactly. Yeah. But it is a memoir about written by someone who was a child actress. She was a star in iCarly, which I had never seen. But even, it turns out, if you've never seen iCarly and know nothing about being a child actress, it is a very compelling book. She's an excellent author. And I think I really enjoy books that just kind of bring me into a world that is very different from my own and give me a perspective that helps me to just look at something I wouldn't have looked at before. So in this case, it's looking at when I see children on the screen, like what is their backstory? What does their life look like to be able to be acting in, whether it's a TV show or a movie? So really enjoyed it. Would recommend. Some trigger warnings there. You can look it up, but something to be aware of before jumping into it. But definitely recommend.
Yeah, what a provocative title.
I know. And I honestly, a little bit of spoiler, I thought that was going to be like sarcastic, but it's not.
you've been warned.
Yeah. Angela, you got something?
Well, I don't have kids, but I think that, so I don't have as much insight into the kidlet, shall we say, but my pick of the week is this podcast called Normal Gossip. I don't know if you've heard of it or listened to it. It is like, oh, it's so good. It basically started the pandemic with this host, and she like reads stories that are sent in by friends of friends. So you might send a story and be like, my friend of a friend, like this happened to them. This like wild thing happened. And she'll tell the whole story to a guest, and the guests that come on it are just these like amazing people in their own right and then are hilarious on this podcast. Like Josie Devery Rice and like Malala, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, went on it like a couple months ago and like she's so funny. And I feel like it's like a nice side of like different people. And the stories are just like, they're amazing. Like she'll pause and be like, which side are you on? Like what's been happening? Like what do you think is going to happen next? And it's so riveting. Actually, I work over like over the mountain pass sometimes, and it's like an early morning or late night drive, and I will listen to this to keep me awake. And it is the only podcast that does that. And it's also just like really nice and light, which is like a welcome break right now with everything, like, you know, in like Minneapolis and in like Gaza. And it's just like sometimes I just need to listen to some gossip.
Angela, I think that you had everybody with light and bright and will keep me awake. I think that every single person who listens to this podcast could use something like that.
Yeah, keep me posted on what you think.
Well, we hope this episode can keep you awake. We've got three fantastic topics.
Nice. You can see, you can't see Brian, but I could tell you had your thinking cap on for
It's tough. You know, these segues are going to be tough, but we'll try. Why don't we jump in, though, to muscular dystrophy, our first topic.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners, whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share real wisdom about practicing medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a hospitalist, and that's FIG scrubs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in FIG scrubs, and I get it, I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable, and it's not just dust. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV, yep, they're in FIGs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that FIGs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine well over 50 times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with FIGs. Now, Cribsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's WEARFIGS.com and use code FIGSRX for 15% off.
So muscular dystrophy was episode 120 with Dr. Kevin Flanagan, who works at Nationwide Children's, with our producer, Dr. Lauren Lettingham. I think when I listened to this episode, I divided it into some big buckets, like diagnosis and differential, and then like what to order and the treatment and stuff. So I thought this episode was really interesting. I feel like I didn't know much about muscular dystrophy, despite having taken care of some patients in residency with it. So this was really cool. We talked about how like it's usually diagnosed around ages 3 to 5 because they're like not meeting their milestones, maybe they're not walking, and they could have had normal development up until that point, which I thought was interesting. And then we talked a lot about how to distinguish between like acute myositis or even like other types of weaknesses like myasthenia gravis. And so having the CK, which we'll talk about in a second, but that it's supposed to be like very, very high in Duchenne's, or like the pattern of weakness is different in Duchenne's versus myasthenia gravis, for instance. Duchenne's is limb girdle, which after hearing multiple times in the episode, I don't know that I could tell you what that weakness looks like, except for the sign of them, the Gowra sign of them, you know, putting their hands on their legs.
Well, do you want to describe that sign just as like something to help listeners? Because I also, when I listened to this episode, was like, oh gosh, okay, do I know what this means? So I feel almost vindicated that you felt the same way.
Well, like, I guess so. Your girdle is your trunk. Is that right?
That sounds right to me.
Yeah. And then so they'll like try to get up, but they can't. And so they're like crawling, and then they instead of just like pushing themselves up, have to like walk their hands back and then like up their legs in order to prop themselves up.
It sounds like kind of a truncal and proximal limb issue. Does that sound reasonable?
I think that's right. Yeah. And it's probably a little different than other like proximal, like acquired myositises because of that truncal portion.
Yeah. I think the other thing that really got driven home on this episode was the importance of the CK and how that can help really put muscular dystrophy higher on your differential than some of the other things that were on the differential diagnosis.
Yeah, like the elevation, I think, was quite, it's quite marked in Duchenne's, like 14 to 15,000, whereas in a bunch of the other conditions we're talking about, it's going to be lower, like elevated, but lower, like 5,000, 8,000. So I think that's a really good point. And then how do you distinguish between Duchenne's and the other more congenital conditions like Becker or the myoglobinopathies? And Becker is, or really any dystrophinopathy that's not Duchenne's, is just a bit more mild. Maybe some people are still walking at 50 or 80. And with a myoglobinopathy, they're like much more sick. Whereas with Duchenne's, maybe they're diagnosed like in the clinic when the parent notices some milestone differences.
I feel like those pieces about the distinguishing it from other things was so helpful, because I think I am still at a stage in my career where a lot of it is just like that recognition and understand. I don't have enough volume to be able to know for a fact what I'm seeing. So just getting that those characteristics set straightforward was really helpful. Another thing I really appreciated in this episode is that he gave some background on the genetic etiology and kind of how this comes about. So a little bit of background about dystrophin. It's the largest gene we know of, 2.4 million bases. And so that's why you see so much muscular dystrophy, because you, with more bases, there are more opportunities for de novo mutations.
Yeah, it's like a bigger target for mutations to happen.
Yeah, we this episode had a lot about dystrophin. I was like, I am back to my, you know, biology class with the zoom in on the little like muscle, you know, cells and how they link, and those like proteins that like walk on the muscle. You know, I'm talking about like graphic, but I thought it was cool to have that like functional end of like, why does this matter? And so, you know, like he was saying how dystrophin like stabilizes muscle membranes. And so like when it's not working properly, the muscle will scar and it'll fibrose. And so that's why your muscles are weaker. And I thought that was like, and then hence why you have the CK elevation. And of course, we know from med school that it's X-linked. And so it's usually in XY individuals, but you can also see it in XX individuals. And sometimes if it's like activated in different ways, people with two X chromosomes can have a pretty severe form.
That presentation in XX individuals was something new for me. I think we think about these genetics in a very binary way sometimes in medical school or in our training. And that was very fascinating to continue to look for not only that in our individuals who have two X chromosomes, but also taking a robust family history.
Yeah, I thought that was really important too. I think speaking of family history and workup, the next part I wanted to cover was the tests, like the actual, what you would do and other kinds of workup. The first bullet I wrote is CK, CK, CK. I wrote it like five times because it's just, like Brian said, so important in distinguishing and diagnosing. And so the case that was brought up in the episode was like a three-year-old who was maybe struggling to walk and had this really like distinct weakness that you see in Duchenne's. And so our guest said if the CK is elevated in this child, it's pretty much, you know, Duchenne's until proven otherwise.
And then if it's normal, it's not, right? It's got a great negative predictive value, correct?
Yes, that was also a great pearl. So you can rest assured if it is negative. We also talked about AST and ALT, and they track well with CK, but sometimes, you know, people can misdiagnose AST and ALT elevations as liver problems because, you know, you associate with hepatic. But remember that especially in children, AST and ALT are like often extra hepatic. And so if you're thinking liver, you should think GGT instead.
And then coming away from the lab testing to the more imaging-based and other testing modalities, he mentioned that EMG is not very useful, which I think is interesting because when I think about a muscular dystrophy, my first thought is, oh, okay, well, let's get something that tells us how the muscles are functioning. And then the muscle biopsy is a tool that is used when there's a negative family history. You don't have any clear genetic mutation, but the presentation is consistent with muscular dystrophy. But if you have a appropriate history or appropriate genetic workup and then an elevated CK, muscle biopsy is generally not performed.
I think this is a really interesting, probably expanding field. Like in 15 years, we might come back to this episode and say, wow, so much has changed. And we'll get to some of the genetic stuff in a second. But I think, you know, what's interesting is now with our like advanced genetic testing and also understanding about how big dystrophin is and all the mutations that can happen and finding new mutations, I felt that was one of the big uses of the muscle biopsy, like you said. You can cast this wide net, and then you could even use it to guide therapeutics for patients, which, you know, we'll get to. And then I think obviously looking at the genetic report and like looking at the patient being like, okay, well, does this match up? Or like, if this is a new mutation, what does that mean for you? Next, we talked about treatment. So the mainstay of treatment would be corticosteroids, like PRED, and that can add to how long they can ambulate for, which I think is just like a really, I don't know, it's a really cool way to think about a medicine that that helps them keep their function for longer. Although, of course, as we know, corticosteroids have their own significant side effects.
I agree. I think adding to time of ambulation is like the most obvious patient-centered outcome that you can, you know, it's something that they can see and they obviously are going to be working towards. And so it's a really, I imagine it must be a really hard conversation of like, okay, here are the side effects, but it can prolong the amount of time you can walk for. I would be very curious to hear the, how those conversations play out. And I imagine it takes a lot of time and a lot of consideration. One thing that Dr. Flanagan mentioned was that he and some of his colleagues will occasionally do different dosing regimens. So maybe have it spaced out or do the total weekly dose given on a weekend, which I'd be curious to know what the impact of that is on side effects as well as overall outcomes.
So a really fun weekend for the kid, not a very fun weekend for the family. Can you imagine getting your total weekly dose of steroids in like 1 or 2 days? I'd be like bouncing off the walls.
It sounds tough. It sounds like that's part of the art of this, though, especially in, you know, a part of medicine where we don't have the best data. But there are a lot of clinicians trying to find the right things to do because steroids have improved the life, but we don't know what dose is perfect. And so I thought it was a great discussion of practice variation within the realm of the reasonable.
Yeah, totally. I think in terms of like the art of treatment, some other things you could do would be like non-steroidal medications, and then nighttime splinting would be helpful with some of that, those like muscular concerns. And then obviously the thing on the horizon is this like genetic versus gene therapy, which if either of you can explain better than me, I would love for you to do that. But I wrote genetic and then I wrote TIC in all caps to like distinguish. But there's genetic therapy, which skips the exon to help make a functional gene, which I find is like, how do you even do that? That's wild. Or there's gene therapy. And this was really cool. It's like a virus associated, or it's an adeno-associated virus. And the virus itself delivers the dystrophin. But you can't be on the therapy if you yourself have adenovirus antibodies.
I have no clue how this works. However, I had one patient when I was in residency who had muscular dystrophy and who had Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, and my co-resident, Jimmy Mayrana, who is now an oncologist in training, got so excited and spent the whole afternoon telling me how this worked. And so I am so sorry, Jimmy, that that did not stick, but but here's a surprise shout out to you. The thing that I do understand and have a soft spot in my heart for, though, is positive pressure ventilation. I think about like comorbidities, or honestly, more like manifestations of the disease. Respiratory compromise is a huge part of life with muscular dystrophy. And in looking at the evidence and listening to this episode, it's amazing how effective proactive positive pressure ventilation and non-invasive positive pressure has been helpful for adding life expectancy to patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Not just the BiPAP through the night, but also cough assist and some airway clearance has been a big part of helping these patients live longer lives.
Yeah, the kids that I saw at Duchenne were actually all on our trach vent floor. And yeah, I just felt like, what a multi-organ, multi-systemic condition, you know, can also affect the heart and the brain, and just, it just can affect so many vital organs. And so I think the more we know about it and the better like wraparound care these patients receive, the better. And so we talked about screening by age 5 with an echo, and then possibly even start them on ACE inhibitors by age 9. And I think, again, like medical advancements, I talked about like how a cardiac MRI can maybe even predict some outcomes about how your heart muscle is doing at an earlier age. And so I think we'll see that move up earlier too. And then dystrophins are apparently also in the brain. I didn't know that, but they are. And so you can see some like cognitive behavioral health comorbidities as well, or like I think structural like brain malformations are also possible. So
I've seen some clinics do this fantastic where they have a cardiologist, a pulmonologist, a neurologist, and some therapies, including physical therapy and respiratory therapy in one clinic. And that is a fantastic clinic model.
I love multidisciplinary clinics. I really would love to be able to send all of my patients with these more complex multisystemic conditions to a place that they can get the services in the same place, because otherwise the care coordination becomes so overwhelming to the families.
Oh, seriously. Well, this has been an excellent discussion. I think we should move from one neuromuscular disorder that has a very unified etiology to one that has a much broader etiology. Sydney, would you mind telling us a little bit about the cerebral palsy episode?
Absolutely. So cerebral palsy was episode 141. Our guest was Dr. Michael McCarthy. The producer was Dr. Hartley Lidsky. Truly one of the most impactful episodes that I've listened to in a long time. So I'm really excited to be able to talk about it a little bit. As Brian just mentioned, cerebral palsy differs dramatically from the muscular dystrophies because it's not an etiologic diagnosis. It's something that is a pattern that we're seeing and then applying a label to. So you're not able to find where that particular diagnosis is coming from in many of the cases. Sometimes you know what the insult was, but sometimes it's truly just you're recognizing it based on the presentation and not based on any sort of specific risk factors. When you talk about the lead up to cerebral palsy, it is anything that causes damage to the developing brain, which according to Dr. McCarthy, it was presented as anytime before 2 years old.
2 years old? I feel like that's old. I don't know why. I had in my brain, in my knowledge base, I was thinking neonates.
Yeah, like at birth.
I agree. And I think that that kind of ties into what I had an understanding of as risk factors, right? The risk factors that we know that I had heard about and that Dr. McCarthy built upon were things like prematurity, which is by far the most common one, but definitely not. It's neither all babies who are premature have CP, obviously, or that all babies with CP were premature. Other risk factors, twin gestation often goes along with prematurity, but not always. The infection intrauterinely, specifically the TORCH infections, it's not any infection, and infection early in life, coagulopathies, issues related to maternal health. It's also controversial, but there may be some genetic components and there are some potential socioeconomic and racial inequities.
So we have damage to the developing brain as the first part of that pattern. What else is part of the pattern?
So the next thing that is kind of essential for recognizing is that it's non-progressive. So if you do see a baby that is regressing or you're having ongoing changes, then that argues against CP. And then kind of the definition of CP or kind of our overarching categories, it's a disorder of movement and posture. In addition to the prenatal risk factors, we also can think about the causes, which can occur in utero or postnatally. So that would be things like intraventricular hemorrhage, infant stroke, or hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. I appreciated how Angela kind of set it up. It's like there were different categories that the information flowed into. So I think the next set of information from this that I got were just the different types of CP. So by far the most common one is a spastic or spasticity CP. This is a velocity-dependent resistance. So the faster you try to move the limb, the more you're going to feel resistance. And this is something that a trained observer may be able to even recognize with an infant, that as they're doing passive movement of a limb, they can recognize that spasticity, especially on the lower limbs. And when they feel the resistance, they can kind of see that as a potential warning sign for evaluating further. Dr. McCarthy made the point that if you see cerebral palsy in clinic, it's probably spastic. That's consistent with my experience. I don't know if either of you have seen any of the other categories in your experiences, but the other ones are there's CP with dystonia, there's ataxic, there's choreiform, and then there's an athetoid one, which is a characterized by slow, small moving, writhing movements.
This was an absolute new word for me. I think I'm going to need some help from a developmental pediatrician before making that diagnosis.
I honestly think I would like help from a developmental pediatrician before making any of these diagnoses. And then when you think about presentation of a baby with CP, recognizing that this often goes undiagnosed for a while, the main thing you're starting to look for are delayed milestones, or in some cases, actually early milestones. And this is, again, because of that spasticity, you can see babies that are standing really early. And so that, again, that kind of blew my mind, is like, oh, parents come in and they're excited and they're like, look at my 6-month-old that's standing, or my 4-month-old, and you have to step back and say, okay, let me look at their other movement patterns. Is this something that would be concerning? Similarly with early milestones, although I don't think this is a milestone that we necessarily look for in primary care pediatrics, but if you see a baby that has very clear early hand preference at like 18 months to 2 years, they really should still be ambidextrous. So if they're really favoring one arm dramatically, that is a sign of that there's a reason to evaluate further. And with that in mind, the babies with hemiplegia will often be scooting when they're moving. They're using just their functional side to move. A baby with a diplegic presentation is usually going to be, when they start crawling, army crawling.
Those are really interesting, I think, beige flags for me. You know, it's like, oh, that's really interesting that you're describing this as something your baby is doing. Let's do a great physical exam. Let's move all the limbs. Let's talk about the risk factors that may or may not have been present at birth.
100%. And I mean, especially army crawling is so common, right? That's also just a matter of them not quite figuring out how to coordinate all of the limbs initially.
And sometimes kids just like to scoot. They've found a way of movement that's good for them, and they stick with that for a while.
100%.
But that's what CP does, though. It's movement differences, though. And so how do we recognize movement differences and then make that diagnosis pretty early, right?
Yeah. And, you know, he brought up the point that, like, it's obviously sooner better than later to get them diagnosed. The sooner they're diagnosed, the sooner they can get into services. But what the services look like at this early age are often things that are accessible even before a diagnosis is made. So it's really that early intervention that we are looking to get the babies into. As soon as you start seeing them off track with milestones, or getting them into physical therapy, regardless of whether you are high or medium suspicion for CP, getting them that support earlier in life.
Really trying to get them into birth to three also, because so many states have strong birth to three programs.
Absolutely. And we know that the earlier that the kids are getting services, the more benefit they're going to get from them. So recognizing that an early diagnosis is better, let's talk about what you have to do to diagnose it. So he did say that MRI without contrast is the gold standard for initial diagnosis. PCP certainly can order. I think Chris asked, like, should I be ordering this? And he said, like, yeah, sure, depends what your resources are. But generally would go ahead and put in the referral to physical medicine or neurology first, just to get things moving. I mean, it depends on the accessibility of various specialists and services in your area. The other reason that it's worthwhile to put in those referrals sooner, though, is because MRI is only abnormal in 85 to 95% of the cases. So it's a very helpful piece for confirmation of a suspected diagnosis, but it's not necessarily going to 100% rule out your suspected cerebral palsy.
I thought this part of the episode was so interesting and just, like, I think illustrates, like, how much of an expert, you know, like, our guest is in this and just how they navigate these conversations. I mean, to tell a family when you see them, when their child is several years old, that maybe something happened before that, you know, we might not know what it is and, you know, wasn't diagnosed then. And I think they mentioned, like, how families can just become, like, really upset and say, well, did somebody not catch it? Like, did they do this wrong? And I think those are such hard conversations to have around anything that comes to medicine all the time, right? Like a family comes to you and they saw somebody else and that person before, like with the information they had, like didn't do what you might do at the present time. And I think the way something, they said something about like, you know, you don't want to sugarcoat it, right? But I think the like, sometimes when you catch it later, it means that it's actually quite mild. And that is, you know, still reasonable that they're being diagnosed now. And I think just that, like navigating without throwing other providers under the bus or, you know, whatever, I thought was just a really, really like artful way of navigating that.
Yeah. Dr. McCarthy had a ton of just gold for how to have various conversations with patients, language to use, which I always find really helpful and really inspiring. So even if you're going to listen to it far faster than Brian is listening to The Lord of the Rings, I do recommend at least jumping into this episode in its entirety. So you go from diagnosis. We were already talking a little bit about referral, right? Because you want to start doing these referrals even before you have a formal diagnosis. But in addition to physical medicine, neurology, usually physical therapy, ortho is often used, but often later as kids are past those early developmental milestones. And then you talked about occupational therapy.
The distinction that I thought was actually quite helpful was PT is often for lower extremities and OT is often for upper extremities. I think that is probably reductive, and I want to be careful about limiting what our great PT and OT colleagues do. But I definitely have had those moments where I'm like, oh, let's just get PT and OT on board, not realizing that there's a big distinction between what they do, and they have very specific focuses.
100%. And I agree that it's probably not that simple, but sometimes it's even just helpful to be able to explain to the families why you need to bring both of those teams on board. You can also explain it as gross motor versus fine motor. Again, somewhat reductive, but helpful as an initial approach. Moving from diagnosis to the main piece that we often think about, which is treatment, Dr. McCarthy talked about a few different treatment modalities. For most kids, initial treatment is either baclofen or benzodiazepines. He definitely leans towards baclofen. Baclofen works as a GABA-B receptor agonist. It is given oral or, in certain cases where more necessary, via intrathecal pump.
Yeah, and I think the thing about the pump, which is outside the scope of this discussion, really, because you won't be managing this, but putting in the pump requires surgery. And then if you suspect that a patient who has a baclofen pump, if something is malfunctioning about the pump, such that they're not getting that continuous drip of baclofen and they're maybe withdrawing, it's actually really acute. Like, you should be getting the ICU involved. You should be paging neurosurgery urgently. And so it's a really big deal to both put in and to monitor for signs of withdrawal. So definitely a very involved discussion to be had before you get there.
And then just for some practical information around baclofen, the most common side effect is sedation. The main concern that is voiced is that it theoretically could worsen seizure control. So I think there's some hesitancy around it with kids, especially with diagnosed epileptic disorders. But again, that's a theoretical thing, not necessarily borne out. And I think he said that he had used it with kids with seizure disorders under good control. And then dosing wise, the recommendation is to start with 0.5 mg per kg per day, divided three times daily, and then increasing by 50% every week up to a maximum dose of two or more. He often does more in select cases, milligrams per kilogram per day. The next treatment modality he really didn't, or the next therapeutic, which he didn't talk about that much, but is the other first-line option, are benzodiazepines. In this case, it would be usually clonazepam or diazepam. I imagine those might be the primary selection in kids where epilepsy isn't as well controlled, especially because those are medications that have benefits for those disorders. But that's going beyond the scope of this episode.
I will say for a lot of patients with complexities who have cerebral palsy who get admitted to the hospital, I've had to rely a decent bit on benzodiazepines as an IV alternative to medications that don't have a great enteral alternative. Honestly, thinking about when baclofen is their main spasticity control. So you can rely on benzodiazepines to a degree, but it really does have even more sedation than baclofen. And then your mileage may vary, right? So talk to your consultants, talk to your pharmacy team before making that switch in an acute setting. What do you do then outside of enteral medications and long-term medications?
One thing about all three of these episodes is just talking about multimodal approaches to treatment. So one other modality used is botulinum toxin injections, which is a cool application outside of what I typically think of with Botox. And botulinum toxin works by interfering with the SNAP-SNARE complex, which reduces the ACH release at the motor synapse. The frequency is really important with this. It's every 3 months or so. It cannot be more frequent than that. Dr. McCarthy said that he does have kids that it can be less frequent, which is fantastic. If they can get mileage of, you know, 5-6 months out of it, then he's thrilled to be able to have this on board. But the risk there is antibody formation. And so you really do need to be using it at no more than every 3 months. And that includes also if kids are getting injections for other reasons like migraines. And one benefit of botulinum toxin injections is that they can be used focally. And so when you have a kid that has lower extremity spasticity, but truncal hypotonia, you can use it specifically in the areas where you are going to need that effect.
So botulinum toxin, not just for wrinkles anymore. Outside of medications, what do we use?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about splinting or orthotics. A lot of these kids have toe walking due to plantar flexion spasticity of the calf muscles. And so to help relieve that, putting them specifically in ankle foot orthotics, you do need that support at the back of the calf can be really useful. And then in some more serious situations, they will use serial casting, especially if kids have so much spasticity, they start to lose the range of motion. And that is often used in combination with the botulinum toxin. Finally, just talking a little bit about some of the comorbidities, which again, I think is something that goes across all three of these episodes, things to look out for. So there is visual impairment, hearing impairment, or oral motor impairment, which he talked a little bit about things related to chewing and kind of how botulinum can be useful for that as well. It is used by ENT for that. Voiding and constipation issues.
Man, I've seen some bad voiding and constipation issues in children with cerebral palsy. I think PCPs have such an opportunity to be proactive here. I also would have a lower threshold to engage our gastroenterology colleagues.
100%. I think with these kids where there's so much complexity and multi-systemic effects, it's important to have kind of multiple specialists on board where appropriate, and also to recognize that even in a kid with cerebral palsy, constipation is still a primary care issue and can often be managed within the primary care setting. Other comorbidities, epilepsy is pretty common, about 50%, and then chronic pain. And then most importantly to recognize but not make assumptions around is cognitive impairment. So that's about 30 to 40% of children with CP will have some degree of cognitive impairment, but that's less than 50%. And so it's very, very important to not assume that.
Yeah, I thought that was a really great call out and something that I don't think that I internalized until you know, that stat that's less than half. We talked about like a huge societal bias, and my favorite line of this episode that I think that we should make the motto of our episode is just because they move different doesn't mean they think different. And so assuming that your patient has cognition that is like in line with their age until proven otherwise is a great motto to keep in mind.
100%. And I think one thing that we didn't even mention when we were talking about this episode is that Dr. McCarthy has cerebral palsy. And so I imagine that this must hit close to home for him to be able to say, like, please do not make assumptions about someone who is moving differently. And then finally, just one other primary care thing that I loved from this episode, which kind of is a call out from everything else, is that talk to these patients from this category and honestly in all of these, with all of these different diagnoses, talk to them about sex. It is a huge part of these kids' lives as they go through adolescence and adulthood. And I think a lot of times there's a tendency to just completely avoid it, again, in people who move differently. And then it's even more important because patients with disabilities are at a higher risk of intimate partner violence. And so just making sure that they are aware of what consent looks like, what safety around around sex looks like.
What a fantastic call out. That's so great. Again, on all of these episodes, don't forget to be a primary care pediatrician if you're a primary care pediatrician. We're on to our last episode. Can you believe it? We have Trisomy 21. This was episode 126 with guest Dr. Hannah Kepler and producer Vishak Venkataraman, who did an excellent job with his first episode on our team. I just wanted to start this with saying I thought this episode was chock full of screenings and risk factors and so many pearls. I have a great love for this 2022 AAP paper titled Health Supervision for Children and Adolescents with Down Syndrome by Bohl et al. For primary care pediatricians, there's just a great chart at the end of that. So listen to this episode because it goes through a lot of the nuances and then refer to that chart every time children come in to jog your memory about some of the things that we talked about. But like everything, we should start with what is Trisomy 21? Trisomy 21 definitionally is when a patient has three 21st chromosomes and is often caused by meiotic non-disjunction, throwback to your bio undergrad classes, or sometimes a Robertsonian translocation, which is about 3-4% of patients with T21 actually don't have a third 21st chromosome, but do have the extra genetic material that causes the syndrome. My fun fact that's not in this episode is that the Robertsonian translocation was originally found in grasshoppers, which I thought was really fun. It's usually like flies that things are discovered in. Trisomy 21 is usually caught by non-invasive prenatal testing, but typically a postnatal karyotype is recommended to confirm. Sometimes there are some other ultrasound findings that are consistent with the diagnosis, but these days it's most often the NIPT. And so from there, oftentimes families will have some sort of expectation or find out early on that their child has Down syndrome or Trisomy 21. And so this episode was structured as if you're going through a life with T21, starting with a newborn nursery through infancy, childhood, and adolescence. So I figured we'd just go through some of the things that you see with T21 and then pause for some of the extra clinical pearls. On physical exam, most notably is hypotonia, hypotonia. Hypotonia can lead to a single palmar crease. And I thought that was interesting. There's actually an etiologic connection to that. So most things with hypotonia will cause a single palmar crease, but the most common cause of hypotonia in infancy is usually trisomy 21. And then there's also what's referred to in some textbooks as the T21 facies, which can be hard to define. And some people will just say, you know it when you see it, but it's usually a small head, flat nasal bridge, epicanthal folds, and upslanting palpebral fissures. I always forget which one is upslanting and which one is downslanting. Upslanting is like a V, so down towards the nose and up towards the ears. The other one that I've seen a lot is cutis marmorata, which is that kind of reticulation on the skin, and then brush field spots and cataracts. Brush field spots and epicanthal folds. I don't know if you two know how to describe these well. I would just look up a picture of this.
When we think about those kids, I think one thing that stood out to me is that you're not necessarily going to send these babies to a NICU. Let's say it's diagnosed prenatally. It's the same indications that apply as for other kids. That said, there are some unique challenges that to be on the lookout for. So one of them is that there's a higher risk for feeding difficulties. So definitely getting the lactation consultant on board if that's not already a standard practice in your hospital.
Yeah, they're also at higher risk for for feeding difficulties of any cause because of the hypotonia, but also at risk for intestinal atresias, duodenal atresia being kind of the board's question, but all intestinal atresias. And then high risk for heart disease, which would be an indication to go to the NICU or to a higher level of care. There's also a higher level of screening for heart disease. So every baby should have an echo before leaving the newborn nursery, at least in some systems. And then the other screening is a CBC for transient abnormal myelopoiesis, or TAM. by 3 days of life, which is something that I totally would have forgotten. So out of the newborn nursery into infancy, there are a number of risks. And so these babies really deserve early intervention and being connected with your birth to three by state, really as soon as the first visit or as soon as the family would be ready.
I think something else that was interesting, and this kind of connects back to the newborn nursery too, you know, because you get your newborn screen both at birth and then a little bit later too, at least in my state. And, you know, you should be screening all babies with trisomy 21 for thyroid issues. And so, but every state has a different newborn screen. So really just making sure that your state, the one that you are drawing it in, has TSH and not just free T4, because that's the test you actually want on the newborn screen.
I agree that was a fantastic pearl. Another thing that you're going to want to be looking out for in these infants, and this is one that I am constantly noting in the newborn note, is that they are at increased risk for hearing loss. And so making sure that all of these babies should have a repeat screen at 6 months of age. And then one thing that really stood out to me is if you cannot see the tympanic membrane because these kids have narrower ear canals, refer them to ENT because we do need to visualize what's going on there. And I think that sometimes in a kid with narrow ear canals, I'm like, oh, it's just user error. The next person will be able to see that. So recognizing that this is a common presentation and warrants getting specialist support if necessary.
Yeah, I think something that's, you know, in this episode and also all of these episodes is knowing when to treat your patient like any other child without any comorbid conditions and when they need some special attention or screening. So for instance, in trisomy 21, treat them like any other child, they should get all the routine vaccinations that are recommended. And they might qualify for a second RSV vaccine if they are at higher risk with their medical comorbidities. But then treat them like they have trisomy 21, like you should follow trisomy 21 specific growth curves, which I didn't know these existed. I didn't see a lot of T21 in my residency. I have been informed that it is in EPIC, which is pretty cool. And then, of course, I think before we move on to talking about childhood and the growing child with T21, I think just making sure that we mention that there are pretty significant inequities in trisomy 21, probably in all areas. And so we just did a brief lit review before recording this. And for instance, there's been an increased diagnosis rate in like Black, Latina, and American Indian, Alaska Native patients, but probably not because they're getting trisomy 21 more. It's probably just because they always had trisomy 21 and now we can recognize and have increased awareness. At the same time, we have inequities on the other side of the spectrum for treatment. This is really multifactorial, obviously, as with all health inequities, but that their studies show that Black patients with Down syndrome present to the hospital and have acute complications more than their white counterparts. And so I think this is a really interesting area of study that is developing.
It's one of those classic disparities conversations where there are so many things that you can take the approach that says, well, then we really have nothing to tackle. But honestly, there are just so many opportunities for us to reduce these disparities and improve care for patients with trisomy 21. Through childhood, there are even more developments that we need to kind of watch out for. Children with T21 are at higher risk for eczema, celiac, type 1 diabetes, and autoimmune thyroid disease, in addition to the thyroid dysplasia that they're at risk for in infancy. And so there are a number of screening tests that we ought to be doing. I think most of these are annually, TSH and a CBC with ferritin. We were talking offline about testing for metabolic disorders also, and we'll touch base on this in just a second. But as indicated as a general pediatrician, if you have a suspicion, you can certainly test for more things than just thyroid and celiac. Patients with trisomy 21 with the hypotonia are also at higher risk for obstructive sleep apnea, and so sleep studies are typically recommended. And then I thought this was very interesting. They're at risk for autism as well and ADHD, which are two things that I think could be totally missed if you're not paying attention. You can have more than one disease process, and you can have more than one neurodevelopmental difference. And then a very fascinating and challenging diagnosis is acute regression in Down syndrome. I saw this once in residency, and it was very challenging. I would have a low threshold to talk about talk about this patient with a developmental pediatrician, but honestly, just being aware that acute regression and Down syndrome is something that happens from time to time. Certainly worth reading a little bit more about. It seems like it's just a loss of milestones and then often with significant behavioral changes.
And Brian, what about then when we're going from childhood into adolescence? What are the things that you should be thinking about, counseling about, et cetera?
Yeah, getting your patient out into the world and, you know, focusing on things that are about quality of life with the knowledge that these patients will have some new and different risk factors. One of the most interesting risk factors is the atlantoaxial instability. So that instability at the top of their cervical spine that can lead to spinal cord compression and severe injuries. It used to be something that pediatricians would do to screen with x-rays, but it's no longer necessary. I think the yield of a screening x-ray is low enough that it's no longer recommended. However, patients with trisomy 21 should use extreme caution or even abstain completely from contact sports, thinking especially like football and things like that. There's also, I'm pretty sure in that article that I mentioned at the top of the episode, a specific caution against trampolines, which I thought was both hilarious and poignant.
I will say, as someone in general pediatrics, I would like to provide an overall general caution against trampolines, regardless of whether you have atlantoaxial instability or not.
Yes, abolish the trampoline park.
Wow. Okay, we've got some trampoline haters here. I think I'm...
You know, I once had a birthday party at, is it Sky Zone? The place you can like jump off all the trampolines. And I went after my prefrontal cortex had developed. And I just remember looking around and being like, I don't know that we should be here, actually, at any age.
Childhood is no time for prefrontal cortex, Angela.
This birthday party was during med school, I think I should clarify.
It's fantastic. It's honestly what it brings up a good point, though, where we need to have this risk benefit in everything. And I do think there's high risk with the atlantoaxial instability, but there's also a high risk for metabolic syndrome for patients. And so how do we encourage a healthy lifestyle while making sure that that healthy lifestyle is brought about in a safe way? So watch out for patients developing metabolic syndrome with trisomy 21. And that's where a screening A1C and lipid panel is not specifically recommended for trisomy 21. But if you have specific concerns, it's certainly warranted.
100%. And then when we're thinking about the transition into adulthood for these kids, definitely making sure that you're discussing sexual development, same thing that we brought up with the last episode. But worth noting that 15 to 30% of females with trisomy 21 are fertile, and of their offspring, 50% will have trisomy 21. So it's I think depending on the age, it's a different conversation with younger kids. It's having a conversation just the same way you would with everyone around what puberty is about. I mean, we could go into all of this primary care stuff. But as they get older, I think also having the reproductive risk conversation is warranted if you feel comfortable with that in a general pediatric setting.
Yeah, I think we talked briefly about risks for intimate partner violence and domestic violence and in cerebral palsy. I think that's an important conversation to be had here also, as well as age appropriately talking about appropriate and inappropriate touch and things like that. I think this is a great opportunity for general pediatricians to help protect our patients with developmental differences. And then as our patients grow up, help kind of all sorts of things like transition to an adult provider, and then helping coordinate guardianship was something that was not on my radar, but was brought up specifically in this episode. I don't know if either of you have experience doing this. I certainly don't, but I think it would be a robust clinic that helps coordinate guardianship, but certainly sometimes paperwork that is not medical just needs a little bit of our credentials to push it over the finish line.
Yeah, I don't have experience with that, but definitely something that requires a lot of care coordination and just advocacy from your medical team also. I think what I love about these three episodes as we think about wrapping up is that what a great recap. Like, learned so much from the pathophys of like different proteins and genetics and all the way. I just think it's cool to be like, this is the gene that's affected. And here are all the different ways it manifests, including thinking, like having a human-centered approach the way we think about our patients. I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, it's really important as a pediatrician, primary care specialist, otherwise, to know how to take care of these patients in a holistic manner. And these patients are growing older, right? You heard about all of these advances in care, the genetic therapy, the ability to have that, like, you know, NIPPV, and just all these advances in medicine. And the whole point of that is that our patients can live and thrive to become adults. And so I think we'll also start seeing more and more of these patients in adult medicine. And I think it was on the CP episode where they were talking about how like IM really doesn't get a lot of training into this, but they're gonna have to because these kids are coming. And so I think it's just a nice way to think about, yeah, how to transition these kids out of the care of pediatricians into internal medicine and keep that wraparound care.
Yeah, the Cribsiders has always had a like secret med peds slant. Send this to your med peds colleagues. Send this to your adult medicine providers. I think that's a fantastic plug, Angela. It's not so secret anymore, I guess.
Just send it to your friends, no notes.
Well, with that, this has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes at www.thecribsiders.com.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com.
We hope you've really enjoyed spending this hour with us. A special thanks to our showrunner, Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media expert, Denise Cruz, on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Angela Weising.
This has been Sydney Engel.
And I am Brian Ward. Thank you and good night.